Thank you all so much for coming. My name is Jeffrey Higgins. This is Elaine's. It's my wife Cynthia's restaurant. It's all the food you're eating is based on her family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt. So I hope you're all enjoying it. Thank you for eating and drinking. We've turned this into a literary salon. And Tom, I think you're 128th maybe author that I've interviewed since we've opened. So it's really good to have you here today.
Well, it's an honor to be here. I certainly appreciate you hosting me today. Elaine's is a wonderful restaurant and a wonderful literary space here, so it's really great to be here. And my thanks to all of you for taking the time to come out. This is really quite an honor, and it's great to see everybody. I really appreciate you taking the time to come out on this hot day.
So we are we're recording this for a podcast, and we're also doing it live. So let me check. Can everybody in the back on this side hear us okay? Good. How about back here? You can hear us okay? Okay, wonderful. So Tom Young served in Afghanistan and Iraq with the Air National Guard. He has also flown combat missions to Bosnia and Kosovo and additional missions to Latin America, the Horn of Africa, and the Far East. In all, Tom logged nearly 5,000 hours as a flight engineer on the C-5 Galaxy and the C-30 Hercules while flying to almost 40 countries. His military honors include the Meritorious Service Medal, 3 Air Medals, 3 Aerial Achievement Medals, and the Air Force Combat Action Medal. Tom retired from the Air Guard in 2013 after more than 20 years of service. In civilian life, he spent 10 years as a writer and editor with the broadcast division of the Associated Press, and he retired recently as an airline captain based at Reagan National Airport near Washington. Tom holds a BA and MA degrees in mass communication from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His well-received military adventure novels include The Mullah's Storm. I read that one. It's excellent.
Thank you.
Silent Enemy, The Renegades, The Warriors, and Sand and Fire. The Mullah's Storm was a Book of the Month Club Thriller of the Month and an Indie Next List selection. Publishers Weekly gave star reviews to The Renegades, Silent Enemy, and The Warriors. The Mullah's Storm earned a star review from Kirkus Reviews. The Mullah's Storm, Silent Enemy, and The Renegades received gold medal awards from the Military Writers Society of America. And Sand and Fire received a starred review from Booklist. That's quite a list you got there. That's fantastic.
Thanks.
Young is also the author of the nonfiction book The Speed of Heat, an airlift wing at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, which released in 2008. His narrative, Night Flight to Baghdad, appeared in the anthology Operation Homecoming, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the home front in the words of the U.S. troops and their families. The Washington Post listed Operation Homecoming among the best books of 2006. And we're here today to discuss his latest book, The Map Maker. So please welcome Thomas Young.
Great to be here. Great to see you all.
So, Tom, you've such an interesting life, so much I'd really like to talk to you about. We're going to try to limit this about 45 minutes, and then I'm going to come around with questions, and I'll bring the microphone and the recorder so that we can get this on the podcast as well. Why don't we start off with, tell us about The Map Maker, just give us a little bit without any spoilers. What's the book about?
Okay, well, the setup for The Map Maker goes something like this. I have two main characters. One is Charlotte Deneau. She is a French-American woman who is working for the French Resistance. Charlotte was an art student, and she has turned her talents to drawing charts and maps and diagrams and so forth to provide targeting information on German positions and capability. And she provides this information to the Resistance and to the Allies. The problem is she's a little bit too good, and the Gestapo knows about her. And as the novel opens, she is on the run across occupied France. And what she really needs is a ride. She still has important information. She needs to get to the Allies. She's trying to stay a step ahead of the Gestapo to keep them from dragging her into an interrogation chamber. And she needs a flight out. Meanwhile, my other main character is a French pilot, Philippe Girard. And he was a pilot for the French Air Force until the fall of France, and after the fall of France, he got out of occupied France, and like a lot of real-life pilots in Nazi-occupied countries, he made his way to Britain and continued the fight as a member of the British Royal Air Force. So as the novel opens, he's flying for the RAF in what they call the Special Duties Squadron. Nowadays, we call it Special Operations. And his unit is, it's a real-world unit. And they flew light single-engine aircraft, the Westland Lysander, in and out of occupied France by night, navigating by moonlight. Sometimes they would deliver supplies and ammunition to the resistance. Sometimes they would pick up resistance agents to bring them to Britain for consultation. And then they would fly them back into the fray in France. It's a hell of a way to commute to and from work, but they actually did it. So they really did some pretty swashbuckling stuff. And Philippe gets tasked with finding Charlotte and bringing her out. But that's harder than it may sound, because she's on the run and she can't stay in one place for any length of time. And even if Philippe does get information on where she's located, does he trust that information, or is it a Nazi trap and are they trying to lure him in? If you read the memoirs of these RAF pilots who were flying in and out of these clandestine fields in France, one of their greatest fears was to land at a landing site and they find out, as they called it, it's been burned. Or they would use the French word, they would say the landing site is brûlé, which means the Nazis know about it and they're there waiting. So that's the setup for the mapmaker.
That's fantastic. I love reading these kinds of books, so I get all excited just hearing you say that. I'm always interested, do you remember like the germ of the idea for this one? You've got a couple of different plot lines going and coming together. How did you first come up with the idea for this?
When I do these World War II novels, I try to look for some of the lesser-known corners of World War II history. I mean, now we're 80 years out from the end of the war, so by now, World War II is pretty well-tilled ground for fiction. So I like to look for some of the offbeat, lesser-known corners of history, and the air operations that supported the French Resistance, at least to me, were not very well-known. And being an old airlifter myself, anything that's got to do with airlift is interesting. And so I started reading more about these special duty squadrons. And I found a couple of videos on YouTube, interviews with some of the veterans who actually flew in these units, and was pretty fascinated. So the idea just kind of rolled from there.
So you cross, like, multiple genres here, right? Your military fiction, your World War II history, you know, it's really thriller the way you write. How do you balance, like, the tropes and the reader expectations when you're crossing genre like this?
I try to remember some of the best advice I was ever given about writing fiction. And I think this applies to any kind of fiction, but it goes double in the type of books that you and I write. And that is tension on every page. When we study fiction in English classes in college or in high school, you hear about the conflict and the climax of the conflict, but what doesn't get emphasized so much is that, especially in our genre, military or military-adjacent thrillers, you need to have tension on every single page. And I just try to write with that in mind.
So when you're talking like military fiction, there's readers tend to like specs, right? I'm thinking of the Clancy reader, somebody who wants to hear about weapon systems, they want to hear about aircraft. I know people who read outside that genre often, that loses them or they skip across it, you know? So how much of that do you have to put in there? And do you feel like your readers are seeking that when they go from page to page? Like, you have an aircraft, right? These cool World War II aircraft. How deep do you go into what the aircraft is and your descriptions and the capabilities? And is there a line where you feel like you might be losing people? Or do people like me just love to read that stuff?
Can you be a little more? Jeff is having
a Okay. That's a great question, because I try to do this kind of research, and you need to have in enough detail for authenticity and to let the reader know what's going on, but at the same time you don't want to do a data dump. I think it was Ernest Hemingway who said, when you know a subject well enough, you know what to leave out. And another of my writing mentors gave me a good piece of advice on using this kind of research. You know, there's a temptation to use all of it, but you really shouldn't do that. And he told me, let the reader overhear the technical details. For example, if I say a pilot character is setting up for an ILS approach to runway 1 left at Dulles, you don't need to know that ILS stands for Instrument Landing System. You just need to hear the tech talk. So it's kind of a balance that you have to strike.
So when you have characters speaking to each other and they both know what they're talking about, they're obviously not going to describe it. So you just avoid, like, as the writer, like, doing some exposition or telling people what that is and let them figure it out?
Right, right. I try to let the context tell them what's going on. You know, you don't need, you know, to go back to my previous example, I don't need to explain what an ILS localizer is, but if there's tech talk between a captain and a first officer, the reader's going to understand they're setting up for an approach.
So you've got the subject matter here, right? So it's the resistance, but it's also the photo reconnaissance. What was it about the photo reconnaissance that got you excited? And it is something we don't read much about.
That's another reason that I chose that corner of World War II history is you don't hear a lot about photo recon, but another of my literary heroes who also makes a cameo appearance in The Mapmaker is the French author and aviator Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. And in his service in World War II, he was a photo recon pilot. And one of the books that I read was his memoir of his time flying in the French Air Force during the Battle of France, a searing memoir called Flight to Arras. And I read that as a kid, and that's part of what got me interested in military aviation. And that was a corner of history I had never heard of until I read that book. And it's very poignant, too, because he writes about the losses they're taking and his frustration, for example, his frustration with the command structure. Those pilots would risk their lives bringing back photo recon photos, and sometimes the command staff wouldn't believe them. And they would say things like, you have to be wrong about where you were located when you took these photos because the Panzers can't possibly be that close. Well, yes, they were.
So it's obviously changed a lot, right? So you have this real low-level flight for photo reconnaissance in World War II, all the way through, like, you know, Gary Powers and the U-2 high-altitude flights, and now you're seeing, like, with this with the recent controversies with Iran, right? You're seeing a lot of satellite imagery. You're seeing drone surveillance. So how has the role of the aircraft changed in photo reconnaissance? Like, is there much of a role for aircraft-driven photo reconnaissance today?
I think there's less of a role for piloted aircraft. We're doing more and more with drones. But historically, I've just been fascinated when you look at the through line of aerial photo recon and how that developed. I mean, it started in World War I with crews taking pictures with handheld cameras. And then by the time you get to World War II, the U.S. was using a modified version of the P-38 Lightning as a dedicated photo recon platform. And then that led to the U-2 and the SR-71 and uncrewed aircraft like the Global Hawk. So it's fascinating to see how that has developed over the years.
So this book, first off, congratulations on the book. And so it's well written like all the others. How long did this thing take you to write?
2 years. The shortest I've ever written a book was 1 year. And I can do that when I have a contract and a deadline and a fire is lit under me. And actually, I had a contract for The Mapmaker when I wrote it as well. But I had a pretty forgiving deadline. And while I was writing it, I was also busy flying for an airline. I've since retired from the airline. I'm not completely retired. I'm working as a consultant now for the Flight Safety Foundation. But as I was writing The Mapmaker, I was quite busy flying. So that's why it took me 2 years.
Do you still get, how many books have you written now in total? It's quite a few.
The Mapmaker is novel number 9. It's my 10th book, if you include the nonfiction book, which is an oral history of my Air National Guard unit's missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's the one titled The Speed of Heat.
And have you do you have any manuscripts that haven't been published, or have you published everything you've written?
I have one manuscript that has not yet been published, and it's completely different from anything else I've written. It is sort of a Southern Gothic crime thriller, and I don't know what its future is going to be.
Yeah, that's not on brand for you.
Maybe I should stay in my lane.
So after 10 books, when these books arrive and you open your box and you see your books again, does that still have the same kind of excitement?
That never gets old. Never.
People don't realize how much effort really goes into these things. You know, do you still enjoy the process? Do you still enjoy the actual writing of the book?
I do. In fact, I think I still enjoy the writing more than anything else. Of course, events like this are just wonderful when, you know, great folks like you all come out. But you don't get to this part unless you do a lot of writing. And to stick with it through 80,000 words, you really have to enjoy it. And I do enjoy the writing.
So let's talk a little bit about your characters. You told us a little bit about Charlotte and her role in the Resistance. Are these characters based on real people, or they're historical figures, or are they mostly made from whole cloth?
They are inspired by real figures, but not closely based on any one individual. For example, Charlotte is somewhat inspired by Virginia Hall, who was an American woman who worked initially with the British Special Operations Executive, and then later in the war, she worked for the American OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was a forerunner of the CIA. To a certain extent, Charlotte is also informed by Violette Szabo, who was a British woman who worked with the French Resistance and did not survive the war. So she's somewhat inspired by a handful of different real-world women who did that kind of thing. And by the way, talking about Virginia Hall, to this day, the OSS Society gives an annual award called the Virginia Hall Award for people who work in the intel or special operations field. Philippe is very much inspired by the real-life Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. Saint-Ex makes a cameo appearance in The Mapmaker, and as I mentioned earlier, there are a number of pilots from German-occupied countries during the war who escaped the continent and came to Britain and flew for the RAF. In fact, just back in May, my wife, Kristen, and I were in Normandy, and we just stumbled across a memorial to Belgian pilots who flew in the RAF and participated in the liberation of France.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, I'm interested to hear about that. But just before we get away from your characters here, I'm wondering, when you write about characters that are greatly inspired by somebody real, or when you include real historical figures as part of your historical novel, do you feel like a certain responsibility to get that right? Or when you're making up dialogue, or when you're making things up, is there an ethical line? I mean, obviously there's no legal line when people have been gone for a long time. They can't come back and sue you, right? But do you feel like you have to represent them properly, or are you able to, how much liberty can you take in a novel with these historical figures?
I do try to be careful about representing a real world figure. All of my novels have historical notes, and in the notes I fess up to what really happened and what I made up. And if I'm taking a lot of liberties, sometimes I'll change the name. For example, in The Mapmaker, Philippe flies for a real British RAF unit, and its real life squadron commander was a gentleman named Hugh Verity. He's not with us anymore, but he lived a good, full, long life. And you can find a wonderful interview with him on YouTube. I believe the title of it is We Landed by Moonlight. But because he's very much a real character and probably still has family, I didn't think it would be right to make up scenes with him out of whole cloth. So I changed his name to Hugh Venable in The Mapmaker, which gives me a little bit more elbow room to make up dialogue and scenes that way.
And you've got a lot of cool settings for this book. You know, obviously the time period itself is really cool, and you've got some interesting places where your scenes take place. So to what extent does setting play a role in almost as character, or to drive emotion or feeling as you're writing?
In this particular case, The the history drove the setting. But having said that, one of the secondary things I was hoping to do in this novel, given that I have a character who's on the run across occupied France, was I sort of made it a tour of the kinds of things the resistance was doing at that time. Charlotte runs into various resistance cells. Actually, back then they called them circuits. She runs into people with different cells and circuits, and we get a look at what that particular part of the resistance was working on. For example, and this is just one example, but as she's on the run, there for a while, she takes shelter with a resistance circuit that is participating in a astounding real-world mission that actually happened in Amiens, France. There was and still is an old prison in Amiens, and during the war, the Germans were using it to imprison resistance agents. British intelligence received word that the Germans were about to execute most of the prisoners who were held in Amiens. So they came up with this absolutely daring mission to come in at low level with light twin-engine Mosquito bombers and bomb very accurately, especially for that day, and breach the walls of the prison to give the prisoners a chance to escape. I mean, if you made it up, somebody would say, that's crazy, that would never happen, especially not with 1940s technology, but they actually did it. It's a mission that came to be known as Operation Jericho. I don't think it was called that at the time, but it has taken on that name, I think, mainly because of a French movie of that title. So these Mosquito bombers came in flying so low that their prop wash was kicking up snow. And they pulled it off. They opened holes in the wall. They bombed the guards' barracks. Of course, there was some collateral damage, and for that reason, the mission has always been controversial. And I can't swear to the numbers, but it's roughly something like this. There were 800 and some prisoners in the prison at Amiens. About 250 of them got out. About 100 were killed in the bombing. A lot of the escapees were recaptured, but a number of them were never recaptured. And given the collateral damage and all that, you could argue about whether the mission should have been done. But if 50 of them got out and stayed gone, well, that's better than all of them getting executed. And as I mentioned back in May, Kristen and I were touring World War II sites, and we made a stop for lunch in Amiens. And I didn't know what the route of the bus was going to be, but darned if we didn't drive right by the prison. And if you look at World War II era photos of that prison, it's out in the middle of nowhere where prisons are normally located. Well, in the years since then, the suburbs have encroached it. So now it looks like it's in the middle of town. But I was talking with some of our fellow tourists on the bus about this, and then we drive right by the prison.
So you've obviously done a ton of research for this book. How much of the research do you do in advance? How much do you do during? Do you go back later in the editing process? Tell us a little bit about that, because I know everyone does it a little differently.
I probably do 80% of it before I start writing. But in the process of writing, there will inevitably come up something that I feel I need to know that I haven't researched yet. So I'll go back and do some more research. And then in the process of editing, the same thing happens. I'll read something, and then I'll go, did I get that right? Maybe I better check again. So the research goes on throughout the whole project.
Do you have any tricks for writers in that falling down that rabbit hole when you're researching really interesting things? How do you just not spend years researching? Because I've actually known writers who've done that. They've spent years and years. They know everything you could possibly know about an era, and now all their creative energy is used up. And they never actually get the book finished.
Yeah, you can't have analysis paralysis. That's never really been an issue with me, just because I enjoy the writing process so much. I'm usually eager to get on with the writing, so I don't tend to get stuck in research that way. But I can certainly see how one might do that, especially if you're in love with the subject matter.
And do you you mentioned earlier, you know, just kind of giving people a hint about, like, the technical details. But when you're talking about, like, a different era, you're writing historical fiction, you've got to give people a certain amount so they know what's going on, right? You can't assume a base level of knowledge, or do you?
You do have to give them enough to understand what's happening. And as far as the technology from World War II is concerned, oddly enough, I found YouTube to be a very valuable resource, because someone, probably several someones, has done us authors and historians a great favor by uploading to YouTube a lot of World War II training films. And those films are brilliantly done. Back then, the War Department enlisted a lot of A-list Hollywood talent to make those films. So they were written, produced, and acted by professionals. They're just really well done. They're as good as any training film I saw in the military, except what I saw was in color, and these are in black and white. And you can find one on anything you can imagine. How to field strip an M1 rifle, how they packed parachutes back then, how they operated those great big backpack radios. And for most of the World War II era aircraft, you can find a film, how to fly the whatever, how to fly the B-17, how to fly the C-47, and they walk you through everything about flying that aircraft from the before engine start checklist to the shutdown checklist. And if ever I run the risk of spending too much time on research, it's on those films, because they're fascinating to me as a pilot. But for example, there's a P-38 that appears in the Mapmaker. So, of course, I watched the film on the P-38. But I probably used a 20th of the information that I picked up, because, you know, as I said, you want to avoid going into too much detail.
YouTube's great. Well, what other resources do you use for research?
I do a lot of it the old-fashioned way, reading nonfiction books, especially if I can find memoirs by veterans who did the things that my characters are doing. So a minute ago we were talking about the British squadron commander, Hugh Berry. He wrote a terrific book about his experiences. So I read that about three times and dog-eared it and marked all over it. So memoirs are very helpful.
How do you handle language differences? Like, you're talking about in the 40s, you know, people spoke differently. There's different slang, different jargon. How do you handle that in the book?
I try to approach that the same way I approach the technical detail. You want to remember it, but use a light touch. So if I have a British character, he's going to use some Britishisms. You know, he might say... He might call somebody old boy or whatever, but you don't want to lay it on too thick. And yes, you do have to remember the times as well, because we use expressions now that Americans didn't use in the 40s, so you got to be careful about that as well.
Did you catch any of that in editing, or did anybody catch it for you?
I'll confess to a possible error in one of my previous World War II novels, but I had a character refer to somebody picking up a phone and ratting them out as saying, that darn Nazi dropped a dime on us. And somebody said, I don't know if payphones cost a dime in the 40s. I think it was 5 cents. So that's the kind of thing you have to look out for. And, of course, I immediately Googled 1940s telephones, payphones, and clicked on images. And on some of them, there's a slot where you can put in a dime. So that made me feel a little bit better.
How often do you get readers that point out errors? I mean, and I've had people point out things that weren't actually wrong, but that they thought were wrong. You know, do you get, like, emails from readers?
Oh, yes. Sometimes they will point out a typo that I haven't caught, which drives me crazy. But now that I'm on book number 10, I've learned to just accept that they're going to happen. Sometimes they will make a technical point, and as you say, sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. And you also learn book to book, that there are things you can expect to hear from people if you get wrong. So you want to try to do your research and not make a mistake. Another of our fellow thriller authors is a friend of mine who's a Navy veteran, and he's published a successful series of Navy-oriented thrillers. And he and I were at the National Press Club, and we were commiserating on this very topic, and he said to me, "Whatever you do, don't get something wrong about a gun."
So, in the research, you have all these new, I mean, it's easier in a lot of ways, but you're reading books, you're doing the old-fashioned way, but you're also going to places. To what extent does being, like, physically being in a setting where you have a scene in your book, how much does that, like, spark your imagination, or how much does that give you additional information when you're writing?
There's no substitute for being there, but to be honest, I've not done a lot of traveling specifically to research the book. I did it backwards. After this book was completed, then Kristen and I did our tour of World War II sites in Europe. But you can find a lot of pictures online. You can watch films and see photos. And to refer back to another of my World War II novels, the one prior to this one was a novel titled Red Burning Sky, and it's about the real-life Operation Halyard, the rescue of more than 500 downed Allied aviators in Yugoslavia in 1944. I wasn't going to go back to Serbia to research that, but I did a lot of searching around, and I've flown in and out of the former Yugoslavia with the military, but that's not like real research. But one of the things I did was I looked for Google Earth images of the area where the action had taken place, and one thing that was fascinating to me was that the village where a lot of the action in the real world Operation Halyard went on was a place called Pranjanya. And back then, it was just a tiny farming village in the middle of nowhere. I found pictures of it on Google Earth and found out that it's still a tiny farming village in the middle of nowhere. So it was just, sometimes it's interesting to see not just what has changed, but what has not changed.
You mentioned flying in Yugoslavia. How much is, like, you've flown in combat? How much has your personal or professional flying experience informed your writing on books like this?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, thankfully, as in the airlift business, I haven't experienced anything like what some of my characters experienced in World War II combat. But there's some things that I can draw on from my own experience. There's some things, even though the technology changes and the missions change, of course, some things are universal and timeless, such as the camaraderie among crew members. One of my good friends and former crew members is with us today. The tension you feel before you take off on a mission, the anticipation, a lot of the emotional stuff you can relate to, because that stuff doesn't change.
Have you had any scary moments as a pilot? You've been flying for a long time. You must have. Can you share anything with us?
Oh, yes. Emergencies just go with the territory. You just get used to that. The crews that I flew with were fired on a time or two in Iraq. Nothing hit the airplane, so it wasn't an awful situation. And when stuff like that happens, it happens so fast, it's over so fast, you don't have time to get scared. And sometimes if you, in the unlikely event you see the fire coming at you, again, it's over so quick, and it's, especially if it's at night, it's like a video game. You know, you're not hearing booms and bangs. You just see lights coming up at you. And if they don't hit you, they don't hurt. In civilian flying, I've had an incident or two. Probably the worst one was an encounter with severe turbulence when I was still a first officer for the airline that I flew for. We tried to get through a gap between a gap in the lot on a lot of thunderstorms, and the gap was closing in, and by the time we got there, it was not wide enough, and we hit severe turbulence and did a 180, but it's probably the only time I've ever been in an airplane, and I actually wasn't sure whether the flight was going to end safely or not, but thankfully it did.
And when you're writing about, like, these old aircraft, I mean, the flight dynamics the same? I mean, you're obviously, all the technology's different, but are you able to convey that or to put yourself into these old aircraft?
Some of the flight dynamics are the same, but it's also interesting what's not changed. A lot of the World War II era aircraft would be difficult for a modern-day pilot to fly without some very specific training, especially things like the single-engine fighters with those great big 1,000-horsepower radial engines. Not to bore you with too much technical detail, but if you really call the power in those things and you don't counter the torque factor, the P-factor, with rudder, it would flip you right over. And there have been accidents because people just weren't used to those kinds of quirks in aircraft of that day. If you were a pilot of that day and you came up through the training program, that stuff would become second nature. But it's not second nature to a modern-day pilot because we don't have that issue. We don't have 1,000-horsepower radial engines in single-engine aircraft anymore.
I mean, at the height of the war, like, if you were an RAF pilot, how much training were they doing, do you know? I mean, weren't they pushing people through pretty fast?
They were. I mean, you read stories of aircraft commanders with 250 hours of flying.
Wow.
So, yeah, they were putting them through the training pipeline pretty quickly.
If you could fly one aircraft from back then, what would you pick?
The B-17 is near and dear to my heart because my grandfather was a mechanic on B-17s. So if I could fly one, it would be the B-17.
Isn't there one that's still flying at air shows?
Yes, there's a handful of them that are still flying. There's a couple of B-29s. There's a very active warbird community, and I've ridden in some warbirds. But the nearest I've ever come to actually flying one was I have about 80 hours in a T-34 Mentor, which is actually not a World War II aircraft. That's a 1950s-era trainer. But it looks like a little World War II fighter, although it's not nearly as powerful. It doesn't have a 1,000-horsepower engine. I think it was 250 horsepower, but it's been a while since I've flown that. But that was fun, too. It had the sliding canopy with a tandem cockpit, so on a hot day like today, you get it up to altitude and wrap back that canopy and put your arm out the window. That was a lot of fun.
So, I mean, you've had a really interesting career. You've been in dangerous situations. You've flown, and so now you're retired from that and doing the safety work, safety consulting. But you're also writing, which is really hard and a brutal business. So I'm curious, like, what is it about the writing itself that draws you to it?
That's a good question. I think it's an addiction I was born with. A lot of times people ask me, when did I know I wanted to be a writer? I think I've wanted to write ever since I could read. It's just, I can't imagine not writing.
Do you remember the first things you read that really captivated you, the first time story, like let your imagination explode?
I remember going into the public library in Oxford, North Carolina, and going to the card catalog and looking for anything to do with flying. And at this point, I'd never even flown as a passenger, so aviation was something I'd never experienced. But I'd heard my grandfather talking about working on the B-17s during the war, and it's something that just fascinated me. And that's when I ran across this book by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry and his other books, and books by authors such as Richard Bach. He's best known for Jonathan Livingston Seagull, but he wrote a lot of other aviation-related stuff. One book I recall in particular was Stranger to the Ground, which is a wonderful title for a memoir by a pilot. Let's see, who else? Ernest K. Gann is another aviation author whose writing captivated me. So, yeah, I have a lot of aviation-related literary heroes.
So it sounds like these two passions of yours sort of were born at the same time.
I think so, yeah. I think I've always been fascinated by aviation. I've always been fascinated by writing. So it was two addictions I was practically born with.
I'm curious about like the process a little bit, but how much you enjoy it and like how you get into flow, you know, like how do you when you're writing, do you lose yourself in the actual creation of the stories? Like does time disappear for you?
It does on a good day, but then there are other days where I have to force myself to concentrate. And the way I handle that, the way I keep writer's block at bay is on any day, if I'm actively working on a book, on any day when I sit down to write, I would tell myself, okay, you've got to get at least 500 words done. And there were times when I made that 1,000 words. But I would set a word count goal for the day. And 500 words is not bad. I mean, you can make yourself do 500 words even on a day when you're not feeling it. But I would make that a goal, and if I got 500 words in 2 hours, great. Rest of the day, I'm going fishing. But if it takes until dinner time, it takes until dinner time. And if you just keep to that schedule, writing 500 words at every sitting, you know, at the end of the year, you've got a manuscript of significant length.
So a lot of, you know, it's hard to make money writing, as you know. So most people have a full-time day job, as you did. Was your flight schedule such that you had days off when you concentrated your writing, or did you try to write every day even while you were flying?
I didn't necessarily try to write every day, but I told myself any day I wasn't flying, I had to write. You know, if I had a late showtime, I might write in the morning. But generally speaking, I would just write on any day when I wasn't flying.
Where do you write? Like, I know people who have to be at their desk, they have to be at a certain place, and other people can kind of write anywhere. Does the environment you're in dictate, like, how productive you'll be?
The environment helps. I mean, my favorite place to write is out on my back deck in Alexandria, weather permitting, and if the weather isn't permitting, then I would rather be in my study in Alexandria. But when I got my first contract for my first novel, and the contract called for a sequel, with a deadline, that's when I told myself, all right, now you got to write whenever you have time and not just when you feel like it. So sometimes that meant writing in ideal situations, and sometimes it meant writing in hotels. Sometimes it meant writing in the crew bunk of an aircraft. At times I've written at Bagram Air Base, Afghanistan. So you learn to write when you've got time to write.
I mean, there's definitely a difference in pressure when you're on deadline or people have paid in advance and you have a book due. But how does that affect, or does it affect your creativity? You know, some people need to be unpressured. They need like a space for story to come to them. But when you're on deadline and you've got to get words down, did you find like that affects either the quality or the enjoyment of the writing?
I've known some writers who were frightened by deadlines and even had their writer's block worsened by deadlines. But it's never been that way with me. A deadline tends to light a fire under me. For one thing, if you have a deadline, it means you have a contract and you know you're not wasting your time. The journalism experience also helped, and I have friends here from the Associated Press and they can attest to this. You know, we're used to a deadline that's like, in 15 minutes, where's that news watch? So if the deadline is a year from now, that's easy.
So the external motivation is helpful in production.
It is. It is.
And what do you use to write? I mean, I've interviewed people here who use pencils and paper and dictation and some people write on their phones. What tell us about the software? How do you actually put this thing together?
I am so old school. This is my word processor. I like to write the first draft in longhand. For some reason, the words, it makes the creativity flow a little bit better, but it also slows me down, which is good, because that means I've got to put a couple seconds more thought into every word before I write it down. And I can compose at the computer. I have done that. But most of the time, I do the first draft in longhand. And if it's on one of those days, you know, when I wasn't flying and I'm doing my 500 or 1,000 words, In the morning, I would write the day's writing in longhand, and then in the afternoon, I would key that into the computer, and that would become the first round of editing.
Is it a mind, like, hand kind of connection that helps you with the writing? Or is it maybe a memory from when you first started writing? So you mentioned you wanted to do this when you were so young. What is it about writing with pen and paper? Because it sounds excruciating to me.
Gosh, I never thought about that before. Part of it is that's just how I started writing, and it's what I got used to. Part of it is I love pens. Talk about being old school. Not only do I like to write in longhand, I like to write in longhand with a fountain pen. I love fountain pens, and I hate computers. So that's why.
Well, what do you do when the candle you're using for light burns out?
Light the kerosene lamp.
So, you know, you mentioned writing on contract and everything. There's a lot of pathways to publication for people now. So you can be, you know, self-published. There's hybrids that you can work with, or you can go the traditional route. Tell us about your decision and how you got to where you are now.
Before I did any of my commercially successful novels, there was a novel that I did self-publish. And I'm not knocking that process. It can be a productive way to get published, but it's not the best way because you're responsible for everything. You're responsible for the editing, for the cover, the promotion, all of that stuff. And it's a lot easier when you have help. And so, of course, if you have a commercial publisher, you have that help. And nowadays, when I talk to aspiring writers and they ask me about self-publishing, the advice I usually give is, okay, yeah, be aware that it's there, and it can be a good option. But don't yield to the temptation to resort to that option immediately for the instant gratification of seeing your book in print. Because, okay, say you're trying to get an agent or you're trying to get a publisher, and you've been rejected 15 times. Okay, well, by then, it might be tempting to self-publish. But how do you know you're not going to succeed on the 16th time? And if you do succeed and you get a commercial publisher, you're going to get better distribution. You're going to have more readers. Frankly, you'll make more money. So I always recommend that people try to publish in the traditional route to the extent that's possible.
Did you go out and get an agent?
I did. I was very lucky. I got a wonderful agent that I met through a contact that I met at the Sewanee Writers Conference at the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. I went to that conference in 2008 and connected me with a terrific agent who is still my agent to this day.
You mentioned these writing conferences. So to what extent, like, you and I met because Dickie Lam was a writer and a literary teacher, and he reached out to me about one of my books, and we developed a friendship and edited each other's work and things, and then he said, hey, I know somebody else in Alexandria. You know, I mean, it's kind of a small community, but so how much does this writing community actually help?
A great deal. For so many reasons. You can be in a writer's group where writers exchange manuscripts and they help each other improve their craft, so there's that. Then there's more formal events like the conferences we were talking about, and they are so useful because that's where you meet people who can help you. I mean, I may not have ever been published had I not gone to the Sewanee Writers Conference and met someone who connected me with an agent. I mean, you never know when lightning is going to strike like that. So they're helpful for that reason. And then conferences are also helpful just because they help you improve your craft. And you meet other writers and you have conversations about the publishing process. And you see that other writers have the same frustrations that you do. So in this business, probably like in pretty much any business, but especially this business, community is so important.
Do you have a writing group?
Not right now. I have been in writing groups in the past, but I'm not participating in one right now. But I probably will by the time I start another novel.
And do you use beta readers for your manuscript or subject matter experts? Or does anybody see this before it goes to your publisher?
Oh, yes, all of the above. Kristen, my wife, is an excellent editor, so she sees it before anyone else does. And then I have other friends who read it for various things. You know, friends in aviation will help me make sure I didn't make some stupid mistake regarding aviation. I have a couple of dear friends who speak French and help me get, in the case of the map maker, some of the French wording right. Fiona Shrimpton is here with us today, and she was very helpful in that regard with the map maker. So I have different beta readers who read for different reasons.
And how is that having your wife edit your work? How is it getting criticism from somebody you love?
She is merciless. But I want her to be. She is not afraid to tell me, hey, this just doesn't work, or this is stupid. And the funny thing is, by the time she finishes with a manuscript and I turn it into the editors, my editors at the publishing houses have really not made a lot of changes in my manuscript because she's already done their job for them.
I mean, that's a huge asset to have that in the house, right? That you have somebody who can do it.
Oh, yeah.
And what is your experience with Knox Press? How has that been? How much have they done for you? And tell us a little bit about working with this traditional publisher.
This is the first novel I've done with Knox. And the first thing that comes to mind when you ask that question is the wonderful cover that they did. I think the cover to The Mapmaker is my favorite of all the covers. Publishers are rightly skeptical about authors' ideas for what their cover should be because so many authors, when they start writing a novel, they have an image of exactly what the cover should be in their head, and sometimes they have strong opinions about that. But a lot of times their firm ideas about what the cover should look like are bad ideas because most writers are not graphic artists. And so in a lot of the contracts that I've had with publishers, there's been a specific paragraph that said I would be consulted on the cover, but the publisher would have the last word. Here again, because I think so many, they probably had experiences with writers who had bad ideas for covers. So in the initial questionnaire that I did for Knox Press about the Mapmaker before I even really started writing it beyond the proposal, the questionnaire asked what my thoughts were on what a cover should be. And they were vague. I just said, well, one of the characters flies a Westland Lysander, and here's a photo of a Westland Lysander. Here's what the plane looks like. All of this flying was done at night, so maybe we should have a dark cover, a somber tone to the cover. And they ran with that and came up with what I think is a beautiful cover.
Yeah, it's very cool. You actually give them more input than I do. I just say you guys are the experts. It's all about marketing, right, for the cover itself. All right, I have one question, then I'm going to go to questions for the audience. This is one question I ask everybody. Where do you think story comes from? And it sounds like a very simple question, but I have people believe they're channeling it. People, you know, where do you think you've done the research, but then these characters come alive for you, and this whole story sort of evolves. Where does that come from?
I don't know if I can say where it comes from, but I will say that there really is such a thing as this concept of the muse. Sometimes when I really get in the groove, it feels like the story is not even mine, that it's coming from somewhere else. You can give that a religious overtone, but the concept of the muse is as old as reading and writing. And it's just fascinating how the creative process works like that. And probably the best description I've ever heard of how that works, at least for one individual in particular, came from the country singer Hank Williams. Somebody asked Hank Williams, where do you get the inspiration to write these wonderful songs? And Hank Williams said, Hoss, I don't write songs. God writes the songs and I just hold pen.
I think a lot of writers can relate to that for sure. Okay, I'm going to come around and just raise your hand if you have a question. Just ask you to speak directly into the top of the microphone so we can pick it up, and I'll use this so we can get it on our podcast. How about start over here? Any questions over here?
Tom, what are you reading lately, and what do you recommend?
Oh, what am I reading lately? I'm reading a terrific novel now by another author who's a friend of mine, a guy named Bob Lee. He is a retired Florida wildlife officer, and he's got a novel called Bones in Water. That's what I'm reading now. And I'm about halfway through that. So, and after that, I'm probably going to turn to some nonfiction. I love outdoor writing, and I've been meaning to read some of the outdoor classics, some of the, you know, hunting and fishing authors, people like Archibald Rutledge, Gene Hill. So, you know, the people who are getting published in magazines like Outdoor Life and Sports and Field in the 60s and 70s. So that's on my next to read list.
Other questions on this side?
Tom, you mentioned briefly your relationships with editors. What kind of agreements or disagreements have you had when editors don't agree with something you've written?
I really haven't had a lot of problem in that regard. Kristen does such a good job of editing my manuscripts before I turn them in that there's really not been a lot of wrangling with editors at publishers. She has saved me that problem.
Hey, Tom, you talked about using Virginia Hall as one of your template for one of your characters. How hesitant were you to actually tell us that? Because, you know, she's such a big personality and such an accomplished person, especially for a disabled woman during World War II. What do you leave in and what do you take out?
My character, Charlotte, she's inspired by Virginia Hall, but I didn't draw her closely enough to Virginia Hall to be concerned with historical accuracy. As a matter of fact, Virginia Hall, the real, quote-unquote, the real Virginia Hall, makes a cameo in The Mapmaker, but it's just a brief scene. But if I were basing a character very closely on Virginia Hall, at the very least, I'd change the name. It kind of depends on the situation. And it's like I did with the British squadron commander, Hugh Verity. Because I was making up so much about him, I felt I owed it to him to use a different name. And put that much more distance between the character and the real-life figure who inspired the character.
Tom, I noticed here you have a memory of Lieutenant Colonel Joe Myers. Who is that?
Joe Myers was a dear friend of mine, a dear friend of Kevin Miller's as well, in the 167th Airlift Wing, West Virginia Air National Guard. And Joe and I, and I'm sure Kevin and Joe, flew thousands of miles together. Joe was a wonderful guy. And he was an aviator and a warrior with the heart of a poet. He was one of my beta readers. He read all of my manuscripts except for The Mapmaker. And he's not with us anymore, but he was a dear, dear friend.
Tom, I loved how you explained when you first start writing, you're using pen and paper. But my question is, now with technology, or once you get that draft, that initial draft, are either you or Kristen using AI?
I have not used AI yet, and that's a very controversial subject within the writing community. There is fear among authors that someday publishers may just use AI to write books, and we may be headed in that direction. I have not used it myself to do any writing or editing. In my day job, the only thing I've ever tried to use AI for was somebody recommended that I use it to record a talk at an aviation conference and to spare me taking notes. So I had a laptop with this AI program sitting beside me, and then I had my own laptop open to a Word document. and I'm listening to what the speakers are saying at this conference, and I'm looking at how the AI is transcribing it, and it was making so many errors, I just turned it off and went back to my old school note-taking.
So you had a happy job flying great big planes, and all of a sudden, one day, you decided to walk the plank and write a book. Why?
Oh, good question. Well, flying the big planes helped inspire some of the stories, so it was giving me material. But I think even before I was involved in aviation at all, I knew I wanted to write fiction of some sort. And then the flying experiences gave me plenty of grist for the mill, plenty of material. And in fact, that reminds me, though, of a story I like to tell about how I actually wound up finally starting on the manuscript for my first commercially successful novel, The Mullis Storm. I had this idea for an Afghanistan war story rolling around in the back of my head for a long time, and was so busy flying, I just had never gotten around to starting to write it. But then once in 2007, I was with the crew of a C-5 Galaxy, and we were flying a load of cargo into Osan Air Base, South Korea. And on the way into Osan, we had multiple problems with the aircraft. We lost a generator, so we had electrical trouble. We blew out a hydraulic system, so we had hydraulic problems. And there were a couple of other things that were going on. I don't remember everything that was wrong with that airplane, but it got to the point where we declared an emergency. And as we landed at Osan, we were greeted by the flashing lights of the crash trucks, but we landed safely. And as we taxied off the runway and down the taxiway and across the ramp to parking, we dripped a trail of hydraulic fluid like a wounded pterodactyl. And once we started writing up everything that was wrong with the airplane and talking to the maintenance people at Osan, we realized we were going to get stuck for days waiting for parts. So I found myself in Osan with time on my hands. So the next day, I woke up in aircrew billeting, and I walked to the BX, the base exchange, and I bought a yellow legal pad. And then I went to the coffee shop, and I got a big, strong cup of black mil-spec coffee. And I sat down on a couch in aircrew billeting, and I wrote at the top of that legal pad, Chapter 1. And that became the Mullis Storm.
Oh, I love that. All right. Any last chance for a question? Anybody?
What's next?
What's next?
Oh, good question. I have not actively started writing another novel yet, but my next project may well be another World War II story, and I've been researching another lesser-known corner of World War II history that is also a fairly unknown corner of Virginia history. But in the 1930s, there was a very successful Jewish businessman, a department store magnate named William B. Thalhimer. And if you grew up in the Upper South, as I did in the 70s, Thalhimer's department stores were ubiquitous. There was one in every mall. But in the 1930s, he was starting to build that empire. And I think at that time, maybe he had only his flagship store in Richmond. And I remember my grandmother talking about driving to Richmond to go to that store. But anyway, he was the national chairman of something called the Refugee Resettlement Committee. And he was very much aware of what was happening in Germany at the time. And he wanted to help as many Jewish refugees as possible get out of Germany. So he came up with a plan to buy a farm in Nottoway County, Virginia. It's in Southside, Virginia, on the North Carolina line, actually not far from our family farm in North Carolina. And he came up with a plan to settle some Jewish teenagers, and maybe some of them were 20-something, on this farm. And he was connected with an agricultural school in Germany called the Gross Reason Agricultural Institute. And his plan was to get kids from Gross Reason out of that school, out of Germany, settle them on that farm, and he really had to thread the needle diplomatically because the Depression was still going on. You couldn't bring in foreign workers who might compete with Americans for jobs. So the way he worked this was he said, They own shares in this 1,000-acre farm in Nottoway County. They're coming to work their land, and the State Department approved it. But this almost didn't happen because it was either the day before or the day after Kristallnacht. The Gestapo raided the Gross Reason Agricultural Institute, and the male students were taken to Buchenwald. Word of this gets back to the State Department and to William B. Thalhimer. And they go into high gear, and they make sure that it's communicated to Berlin, hey, you just arrested a bunch of young guys who have visas to come to the U.S. Maybe you don't want to tick off a large, then-neutral industrial country. So these kids were released from Buchenwald. Not a lot of people were released from Buchenwald, but they weren't. So they all come to Nottoway County, Virginia. They start working on this farm. And then in 1941, Pearl Harbor comes along. The U.S. gets involved with the war. Most of these male students, and probably some of the women too, joined the military. And one of them went back to Buchenwald as a liberator with Patton's Third Army. So I think that's quite a story, and I think he's maybe that character is going to be a main character in some future novel.
That's great, Tom. We got one last question back here.
So with all of your stories and world travels and flying, do you find that any of your writing is somewhat cathartic? Or how would you describe the feeling during, at the end of your finished work? And the second question, really short. Would you describe it as cathartic, or what's conjured up in you feeling-wise when you are writing and then when the book is finished?
I would say it's cathartic to a degree. Writing is a tool that is often used in programs for veterans. Nothing ever happened to me that's bad enough to cause PTSD. So when I say cathartic, I don't mean using it in that way. Mm-hmm. But there are programs that encourage veterans to write, and it is very cathartic for them. And that's one of the ways that PTSD can be addressed. And I think that's part of why the tradition of the warrior poet goes back about 2,000 years. There's a great story about one of my favorite Vietnam War novels called The 13th Valley by John Del Vecchio. And if I recall correctly, I believe the genesis of that novel was he comes home from Vietnam. And then he goes to his father's hunting cabin in the hills of Georgia and stays there throughout an entire quail season. And he's going out hunting quail with his dog in the morning and riding in the afternoon. And when he came down from that mountain, he had the first draft of the 13th Valley.
And then just really quickly, does the writer ever become the reader of your works when those books arrive at the house? Have you ever sat and read one of your finished works?
Usually by the time it's in print, I've read it so many times, I don't need to read it again. But of course, I read it over and over in the writing process and in the editing process. And I find I am not a good judge at all of my own work. Sometimes I'll pick up a page and I'll read it and I'll think, oh, what were you thinking? And then other times I might pick it up and I go, that's pretty good. So that's why I rely on Kristen and beta readers. I am not a good judge of my own writing. You really need outside opinions on that. One of my literary mentors, who sadly is not with us anymore, has a hilarious story about turning in a manuscript to his editor at the publisher. And they're having a conversation on the phone about a particular page in this manuscript, and his editor goes, were you drunk when you wrote that?
So, Tom, we've got Barnes & Noble here. If anyone hasn't picked up a copy yet, Barnes & Noble's in the center room. Please do. It's a good opportunity to support a local bookstore. Tom, where else, for the people who are watching on the podcast, where should they find you?
My website is tomyoungbooks.com, and the Mapmaker is available in hardcover and on Kindle. It will eventually be available in audio. And most of my novels are also available in audio. And they're on barnesandnoble.com and pretty much any other bookseller.
And I have two requests for the audience. If you guys just go on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and leave a quick review for them, it makes a big difference. It only takes like 15 seconds. And if you like what we're doing here with Elaine's Literary Salon, if you could rate us on Google or Yelp or OpenTable or wherever you do that, that also really helps. Tom, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me. Thank you. And my thanks to all of you for coming out. It is so good to see so many good friends from so many different walks of life. And I really appreciate you being here.